disagree, but I could not see it until it was too late. Daedalus, the self-obsessed instrument of his own son's death, could never atone for that sin. But another son of Daedalus, who takes the name of his father and continues his work out of respect for the values he once had, might restore honor to the family, if not to its patriarch. Do you understand?
I think so, John said after a long pause. But I'm not sure what purpose is served by keeping your identity secret from Avon or the caretakers. Daedalus sighed again.
It's not so much that it's a secret, he explained,
watching the others in the near distance.
Every child who comes to Haven takes a new name. To them it's a new beginning, an opportunity to start over, without being judged for who they may have been before. I simply wanted to afford myself the same chance.
By masquerading as yourself? Asked John.
By portraying myself as someone who chose to honor rather than blame, Daedalus replied. But even after all these years, after all the good I have done, my name is still remembered because I murdered my nephew and caused the death of my son.
John shook his head. It isn't what I would have chosen, he said. The fact that you pretend to be your younger son means that all of the good you have done isn't credited to you, it's credited to him. What good is atonement if it isn't yourself doing the atoning? Daedalus didn't answer, but stared hard at John, then turned and walked back into Haven.
Be well, Caveo Principia, he called without looking back.
John watched as Daedalus disappeared into the spires of Haven, then turned and ran to catch up with his friends. The light of the underneath was beginning to change the sky from deep umber darkness to the colors of bruised fruit. In front, Laura Glue led the companions with a bronze lamp that cast a bright glow all about them. Jack, to his friend's slight dismay, skirted the edges of the light, jumping in and out of its gleam, delighting in the interplay of his two shadows. The companions moved in a straight line due west, and as they walked, they discussed the events of the night.
When Daedalus mentioned the King of Crickets, Charles said to Bert, I thought you were going to be felled in a faint. What was it about the name that bothered you so?
Bert suppressed a shudder.
It's another old story, one that proved too dark even for the Brothers Grimm, he said, although it was Jacob who originally retold the tale in one of the histories. The King of Crickets is the quintessential bogeyman, Bert explained. The movement in the dark, the creature under the bed, the monster in the closet. He is nightmare personified, and he is very, very real. There are many such monsters in the world. They have always existed, and probably always will. But what frightened me was the idea that the King of Crickets was also a Pan. That would explain how his legend grew among the children, more so than grown-ups.
Do you think the King of Crickets and Orpheus are one and the same? Asked John, since the myth originated with him.
I hope not, lad, Bert said, shuddering again. From what Daedalus said, Orpheus's only motivation in taking the children was to bring them here, to be playmates to Hugh and William. But according to Jacob Grimm's history, the children taken by the King of Crickets were never heard from again.
Why is it that all fables and fairy tales involve children in peril? Wondered Charles. Was there some great assembly of storytellers that decided the best tales to tell children should also frighten them to death?
It's the Longbeards who do it, said Jack, playing hopscotch with his own shadows. They tell us those stories to frighten us into behaving, so that we'll value their protection. But we don't listen, because we know the one thing that grown-ups forget. All stories are true, but some of them never happened.
Chapter 19. The Gilded Army. Unlike the crossing between Croatoan Island and Haven, which could be forded at low tide, the gulf between Haven and Centrum Terrae could only be traversed by bridge. The west side of Haven ended in a high bluff to which the bridge was anchored. It was constructed of thick cables and ancient wood, which, although weathered and faded, had once been painted in the colours of the rainbow. John recognised the architecture as being Scandinavian, and was nearly too fascinated by it to cross. "There are descriptions of a rainbow bridge in some of the writings related to the Eddas," he said excitedly. "I wonder if this has any relation to those."
"It's entirely possible," Bert said. "Stellan's specialty was Norse mythology, and there are several islands in the archipelago that have deep roots in the Eddaic stories."
"I say," Charles commented, "wasn't the original compiler of the Norse stories, Snorri Sturluson, one of our predecessors?"
A quick check in the end papers of the Imaginarium Geographica showed that Charles was correct. The 13th century scholar had indeed been a caretaker.
"Amazing," said John. "I wonder if Sturluson ever came to the underneath, then.
There were tales about the great serpent, a dragon, basically, that stood guard at the roots of the world tree, Yggdrasil. That bears a great similarity to the story about the golden fleece and the dragon that guarded it."
"Maybe there were clues in the Eddas that can help resolve this," suggested Charles. "What happened to the dragon and the tree?"
"According to the myth, the dragon was slain, the tree felled, and the world died in fire and ice," Bert replied.
"Oh, well," said Charles. "Never mind, then."
The bridge, while old, was sturdy and stable, and they were able to traverse it in a matter of minutes. What they found on the other side, John immediately named an forest. A first-growth dawn of man forest, with trees of such immense stature that every other forest in the world might have only been an image reflected in a child's looking-glass. It was dark, foreboding, and there was only one apparent path to take, directly through the center of the island.
"Oh," Laura Glue exclaimed, "I almost forgot."
She hastily unpacked her bundle and instructed the others to do the same. Inside were red cloaks with hoods, which she explained must be worn before they could enter the forest.
"It's part of the lore of the forest," she said,
fumbling with the tie strings.
"She's right," John said, flipping through pages in the history.
"There's a caution here in ancient Greek, and it mentions the red hoods. It relates to some Spartan legends, apparently, and refers to the red hoods as shields."
"Humph,"
said Charles, who had wrapped the thin red cloth around his shoulders and was now helping Laura Glue with her own hood.
"It doesn't seem sturdy enough to protect us from a drizzle of rain, much less shield us from anything."
Jack was scowling and examining his hood with a look of distaste.
"This is a girl's color," he complained. "Don't we have one in green? Green would be best, but I'd even settle for blue."
Laura Glue shook her head.
"Red is the law color," she insisted. "No other color will work."
John, again consulting the history, concurred. Jack muttered a few more words of protest, but nevertheless did as he was asked. He draped the cloak half-heartedly over one shoulder and fastened the ties with a slipknot.
"All set,"
Bert said, examining the others.
"Then into the woods we go."
The children, that is, Jack and Laura Glue, wanted to take the lead, but Avon wouldn't hear of it. She scouted the path about 20 paces ahead of the rest of them, followed by Jack, Laura Glue, and Charles, with John and Bert bringing up the rear. As they walked, none of them noticed that they were being watched from high within the canopy above, and by more than one set of eyes. They were focused on the path, which for all practical purposes neatly bisected the island. The path was uncluttered, and had once been neatly lined with golden cobblestones, but most had been worn down with use and age, and only traces remained of the yellowish pigment they once bore. Every little while they would find a spot that had been clear-cut, all the lumber having been taken out long before. There was no obvious evidence of the woodsman who had cut the timber, save for something Charles glanced out of the corner of his eye. It was what seemed to be a figure of human proportions, some distance into the wood, away from the path. Statue-like, the figure's arms were upraised as if it had been frozen mid-swing, and then had the axe taken from its hands.
Charles thought he caught a flash of metal underneath the vines that had grown up around the figure, strangling it from view, leaving little exposed, except for the rictus of terror, frozen permanently on its face. None of the others had seen it, and Charles saw no benefit in pointing it out, so they moved on. "The principal use of the history," John was explaining to Bert, "seems to have been to equip travellers against whatever dangers there were on the islands. And it always uses stories as examples, like parables." He thumbed through several pages and then stopped. Near the back was a section that seemed to have been ripped out.
"Maybe that's why Daedalus dismissed any talk of the Ninth Island," said Bert. "He had no reference materials addressing it, or the dangers that we might encounter."
"Or maybe he knew they were ripped out," suggested John, "and chose not to tell us."
"Quiet,"
Avon whispered, holding her hands out to her sides.
"Don't speak. Don't move. We're being tracked."
Slowly, carefully, Avon indicated with a slight nod of her head the dark masses up ahead that the companions realized were living creatures. Up ahead, coming closer, and, they realized with mounting horror, also coming up the trail behind them. They were wolves. Massive, shaggy behemoths that stood as tall as racehorses and carried the bulk of bulls. The wolves moved out of the trees, silent as a child's prayer. They did not look at the companions directly, but slowly moved in widening circles until they had surrounded the small party completely. There was nowhere to run, and there was no possibility of combat. The companions were clearly outmatched.
"You wear the hoods," growled the graying wolf they all assumed to be the leader. "The hoods of law."
"Yes,"
Laura Glue said, emboldened by the creature's ability to speak and, seemingly, reason.
"They are the right color, so you have to leave us be, growly wolf."
The wolf stared at her for a moment, then made a raspy, chuffing noise and swayed its head from side to side. The great creature, they realized, was laughing.
"Little daughter of Eve," said the wolf, "I am Carthos Morris, and I obey the law of Centrum Terre, set down low these many years between my great-great-grandsire and thine own ancestor, the Queen of Sorrows. You wear the hoods, you bear the color, and we are sworn to protect thee."
As he spoke, Jack was hastily repositioning his cloak to cover himself as much as possible. Charles placed a steadying hand on his friend's shoulder, and John and Bert drew up more closely behind Laura Glue.
"Protect us?" said Avon. "Protect us from what?"
The other wolves had already begun to growl, raised their hackles, and looked skyward. The answer to Avon's question was above, in the trees. The silence of the forest canopy was suddenly broken by a fierce chittering sound as the huge, winged monkeys dropped from the treetops where they had been tracking the companions' progress. Snarling, Carthos Morse and the other wolves leapt to the attack, and the companions fled for cover. Shouting, Avon directed the others to the remnants of a structure that was 30 or 40 yards off the path. It had once been a house, but had long ago been burned, and all that remained were the foundations and a few charred trusses. There was also a great stone fireplace and chimney, which Avon herded Jack and Laura Glue into, drawing her long knife as she did so. John and Charles handed Bert the Geographica and the history, picked up stout branches, and took up defensive stances alongside Avon. Laura Glue was more awed than frightened by the spectacle taking place before them. Jack, for his part, was thrilled, and only slightly distracted by the fact that their hiding place smelled strongly of burnt gingerbread. From their vantage point, the companions were able to see the fierce battle. The monkeys were roughly the same size as the children, with wings that were broader than the men were tall. Their teeth gleamed, and their claws slashed out wickedly at the defending wolves. And most fearsome of all was the fact that the monkeys' eyes glittered with a fierce, feral, almost evil intelligence. Carthos Moors and the other wolves took up a V-shaped formation that kept rotating fresh wolves to the front of the battle, which meant that only the thick ruffs of their backs were exposed to the cutting, slashing claws of the monkeys. The monkeys' ability to fly gave them a huge advantage in a surprise dropping attack, but for sustained combat against an organized opponent, it was soon clear they were outmatched. After a few minutes of fighting, the monkeys shrieked their dismay and abandoned the effort. In moments, they had disappeared into the tops of the trees. After assuring themselves that it was safe to break formation, the wolves dispersed into the shadows, except for Carthos Moors, who approached the companions. To their surprise, he again addressed Laura Glue, as if she were their natural leader.
"Daughter of Eve,"
the great wolf began,
"thou should have no further fear from thine enemies. We have honored the law. What else might we do for thee?"
"We've got to cross your island and go to the next one," Laura Glue said. "We're supposed to follow the path."
"Then we shall guide and protect thee," said Carthos Moors, bowing.
Without another word, the wolf turned and began to walk down the path. Laura Glue followed him first, then the others, albeit a bit more reluctantly. In the undergrowth, the companions could see the shapes of the other wolves, pacing them, protecting them. Charles and Bert could not resist casting fearful glances at the sky now and again, but the monkeys did not reappear. Inside of an hour, they exited the forest and found a well-crafted dock with a broad raft and a cable strung overhead to guide the raft across the water to the neighboring island. Carthos Moors bowed again, this time to each of them in turn, before facing Laura Glue. She laughed and scratched the scruff of his neck. The wolf hesitated, then licked her once with a great pink sandpaper tongue.
"Fare thee well, daughter of Eve," he said, before disappearing into the trees.
Moving onto the raft, the companions unfastened the moorings and quickly moved away from Centrum Terrae. Crossing to the next island was much less stressful than the crossing from Haven had been, or even the crossing from Croatoan Island to Haven. As Daedalus had said, the tides had indeed receded, leaving only a shallow track of water to guide the raft through. It beached some distance out from the approaching dock, and the companions were easily able to cross the rough, pebbled ground to the Hulumulu. The pirate island existed in the same geographic space as the other islands they'd seen, but instead of being illuminated by the one, omnipresent light from above, Hulumulu seemed mired in perpetual twilight. There were wisps of fog drifting about, grazing at the edges of buildings before moving on to other pastures. The entire island was built up in a shantytown of shacks and taverns. Every inch of arable ground was covered in hastily constructed buildings that looked as if they might collapse in a stiff wind. There were rings of docks lining the visible shoreline, and surprisingly, they were filled with ships. Whatever or whoever had torched the ships of the archipelago had obviously not done so here.
"Remember Daedalus's warning," Bert cautioned. "He said to skirt the island and avoid any contact with the inhabitants if we can."
Moving under cover of the fog and mist, the companions kept close to the docks, with the expectation of using the bulk of the ships for hiding places if they encountered anyone. But they never did. There were a number of cats mewling about the docks, fighting over scraps of fish and offal, and proclaiming their love for one another in screechy sonnets sung from fence tops. But those were the only living creatures they saw until they reached the far side of the island. There, at a waypost, they found a single, solitary sentry. They would have taken pains to avoid him altogether, but the mists obscured their sight, and they were upon him before they had a chance to hide. He was a pirate, grizzled, old, and garbed as they expected a pirate to be, with broad pantaloons, thick boots, a weathered captain's coat, and a tri-cornered hat. He also wore a patch over one eye and waved at them as they approached.
"Be ye friend or be ye foe," the sentry called out. "Old Pew, he would rather you were a friend, for I'm afeared that my fighting days be numbered, they be.
Unlike with the wolves, Laura Glue was frightened, and she kept hidden behind Bert and Avon. Jack eyed the pirate with a curious expression, though, and Charles and John both realized that a direct answer would be best.
We be friends, yes,
Charles stammered.
Aren't we, John?
John stepped forward and handed the pirate a folded piece of parchment Daedalus had placed in his bag.
Yes, friends, he said.
Pew unfolded the parchment and gasped, then switched the patch to the other eye and looked at it more closely.
You have Hook's mark, he said with awe. Ye may not be friends, I thinks, but ye be not enemy either.
On the parchment was a black spot, but it was apparently enough of a passport to allow them to move through unhindered. Pew took off his hat, exposing a nearly bald pate covered in the thinnest of grey hair, and bowed deeply, pointing. Just past the end of the dock was a large, flat stone, rising almost a foot above the water. Through the fog, they could see that it was only the first of a line of stones, arranged as if to facilitate crossing and heading west.
"Cross if ye be inclined," said Pew, "but best be a-hurried, afore the tide return, and cover the devil's spine."
The companions murmured their thanks, and quickly moved down the dock. Charles stepped over first, and finding the footing to be solid, helped the children, Avon and Bert, to the stone. Only John paused on the dock. "Might I ask a question?" he said to Pew, who shrugged. John took that as assent. "How many of you are there on Hulumulu?"
"What, pirates?"
Pew said, a note of surprise in his voice.
"Why, not long ago we be thousands. But now only old Pew watches the ships. Old Pew and his cats."
"Where did the others go?" asked John.
"Taked,"
Pew replied.
"Taked and used up and kilt. The crusade, men say. The crusade of the King of Tears. Takes a man and uses him up. They left on the ships with the eyes of fire, they did. Left old Pew, and none returned, nor will they."
"Why not?"
"Because plunder and pillage, that's what men do, and God permits. But a crusade be like Babel, and an offence to God, and they be struck down and lost. Seek those whom ye may, but do not pursue a crusade. Only death will follow after."
The stones were evenly spaced, and they led the companions to the next district and the next island in little more than an hour. The mist was thinning and the sky was brightening as they moved farther from Hulumulu. Not far from landfall, Bert noticed that the water level was rising against the stones. The tide was returning.
"It's too early," Charles said. "It shouldn't be coming in again until tomorrow."
"Different district, different rules," said Bert. "I don't think we can count on anything being as we expect it to be from here on in."
They stepped off the last stone onto a granite shore just as the incoming waters covered it over with a rush of sea and foam.
"Just so," said Avon. "Heaven is with us."
"We can hope, daughter,"
Bert called over his shoulder, as he followed Jack and Laura Glue, who began playing a game along the shore. They were skipping stones across the surface of the water, and in a moment Avon had joined them. John and Charles sat on the ground and took stock of their bundles.
"You're so worried about something that I think your eyes are going to cross," Charles said to John, squeezing his shoulder supportively. "What's got you in such a bother, old friend?"
John rubbed at his temples and grinned wryly at Charles. "I'm not certain it's anything at all, but some of the things Daedalus told us don't ring true."
"Really?"
Charles exclaimed, surprised.
"I thought he was very forthcoming."
"That's part of what worries me," said John. "He was very prepared for us. He wasn't surprised when we arrived. And he even knew which history we would need to take to traverse the different districts of the Underneath."
If I may interject, said Bert,
who had moved closer to the two men,
I'd thought the same thing. But wouldn't he have been expecting, or at least hoping, that Laura Glue would return with Jamie, or a caretaker, as she did?
How would he have known to expect that? Said John. He claimed he wasn't nearby when the children were taken, and Laura Glue told us Peter sent her on the mission as the clockwork men were attacking. How would Daedalus have known?
This makes no sense, Charles said flatly. I think you're worried about a dilemma that doesn't exist.
Don't be so sure, said Bert,
who had grown more and more worried as John talked.
I think he's right.
So do I, said John. And with that, he explained what he and the inventor had discussed in private before the companions had left Haven.
So Daedalus isn't Daedalus the Younger after all? Said Charles.
No, said John. Daedalus is the original Daedalus, not his son pretending to be Daedalus.
If he can't leave Haven, Bert pointed out, then he had to have been present when the clockworks attacked.
Which means he did know about Peter sending Laura Glue to find us, said John. So then when we came, why did he lie to us about not being there when it happened? The question, more an accusation, hung in the air, but no one had an answer. John began reading through the history and what it said about the island, which Daedalus had called Lixus. It was the colour of cobalt and nearly barren. In contrast to the heavily wooded islands they had come from, there was no visible foliage, and only great towers of stone ahead.
"Occupied by automatons," Daedalus claimed, said Charles. "Do you think it's possible this is where the children were taken?"
Bert scanned the island and shook his head.
"I can't see why. The clockworks must have been under Orpheus's direction, and so I'm clueless as to what could have brought them here, of all places. John?"
John frowned and bit his lip in frustration. It has a great deal here about Lixus, and some notations made by Pliny the Elder around the 1st century, but it isn't making sense.
Did you feel that? Said Jack.
My stomach jumped.
Not now, Jack, Charles told him. We're trying to decide how to move forward.
Isn't that my decision too? Said Jack.
There, he added. There it was again.
He crouched and placed his hands flat to the ground.
Don't tell me you can't feel that.
But this time they had. There was a tremor, then another, and another. A worried look came over Raven's face, and Bert and Charles each took a step backward toward the water. John was too absorbed in the history to notice that anything was amiss. Yes, he murmured, pacing. It's starting to become clearer. There's only one tree left on this island, and it's in the center of those towers of stone. It may even have been the tree where the Golden Fleece once hung.
The one guarded by the dragon?
Charles asked as another tremor, stronger now, shook the ground.
Fine by me. I'd love to see Samaranth right about now. Or even a little dragon. Really, any dragon would do.
Another tremor struck, this time strong enough that Laura Glue was nearly knocked off her feet.
Hmm, said John.
The automatons are clockworks. It's they who guard the tree, but there's still an inconsistency here. Another tremor struck, and this time there was thunder with it.
I think I have it, John cried. The problem isn't in the translation.
The ground shook, and the island echoed with the boom that followed almost instantly.
It's a misunderstanding of scale, John finished.
Laura Glue's scream interrupted any reply that was forthcoming from the others as a towering figure moved into view. A great bronze statue, nearly 100 feet high, stepped over the companions and bestrode them like the colossus it was.
Talus, the bronze automaton of Crete, Bert said breathlessly. I'd never believed he really existed.
In the stories, Medea helped the Argonauts defeat him, John exclaimed, but it looks like he's recovered.
I hate to tell you this, old boy,
Charles stammered, his voice shaking with sudden terror.
But he's not alone.
In the distance, several more gleaming giants moved into view. It was an army of golden mechanical giants.
The shaking of the ground was constant now, as was the thunderous din of their footfalls.
"Run!" Avon yelled, pointing at an opening between the towers. "We can't stay here in the open. We need cover."
A great bronze sandal crashed down in front of them, throwing the companions to the ground, and one of the giants seized their bundles before the companions could reach them. There was no offense they could mount, but the giants were slow. Escape was possible. John, Charles, and the others dashed between the giants' legs and headed for the stone towers. The other giants had closed in and encircled them, but they were too ponderous to move with any speed, and their stature was so great that there were huge gaps between their feet. The first giant, which Bert had called Talus, reached down with a massive hand, fingers grasping, and nearly had Laura Glue, but she was nimble and slipped through. The towers of stone were close enough to delay the pursuit of the giants, and the companions ran between them, not pausing for a breath, or for more than a passing glance at the great, solitary tree that stood in their center. The island was small, and they ran until they reached the far side. By then, the tremors had stopped, and there was no sign of pursuit. Laura Glue, however, was frantic and sobbing. "It's all right," John said, reassuring her. "We've escaped. They don't seem to be following us now."
"They don't need to follow us now," Laura Glue cried.
"What do you mean?" John asked. "They've got our bundles, but we managed to keep the history and the Geographica."
"John, you don't understand," said Avon. "It's Jack. They took Jack."
Chapter 20. The City of Lost Children. In his dreams, there had been giants, but they were not golden, and they had not taken notice of him, as had Talos and his fellows. The fingers of the giant automaton had formed a cage from which he could not escape, and the crashing footfalls had made it impossible for Jack's friends to hear his cries. He was a prisoner, he was alone, and he was only a child. But he still had his mind. He was still himself, still Jack, and he still had his scholarly training. Passive observation, not panicked action, was what was called for here. And so he waited and kept quiet. Once Talos realized that his small captive was not going to struggle or try to flee, he relaxed his grasp enough for light and air. Jack looked between the giant's fingers at the ground below, which was a mistake. His stomach twisted and turned, and finally he retched, spilling his last meal from Haven across the broad golden palm. The giant never noticed. Jack decided that whatever else he was in for, he ought to at least not make himself ill on top of being terrified. So he closed his eyes, sat back, and tried to think of more pleasant things. Thus calmed, it was only minutes before the boy professor fell asleep. Despair. That was all the companions could feel, a dull, throbbing ache of despair. Despite all they had come through, all they had endured, they seemed no closer to discovering what had happened to the children of the archipelago, or the missing dragon ships, or Avon's own son. And now they had lost their friend to an incomprehensible foe. "I can't bear this any more," John said miserably. "Every time we've come to the archipelago, it's to fail, to come up short. Every time we run as fast as our legs may carry us, and fight with every last breath in our lungs, and it's never enough."
"But it is enough," countered Bert. "Don't you see, John? It is enough. Remember what Stellan told you in the tower?"
As if in answer, an enormous granite block fell from the sky and crashed into the water, close enough to drench them all with the spray. A moment later, it was followed by an oaken door which slapped the surface like a stone, skipping once, twice, then stopping. It was one of the doors from the Keep of Time.
"You mean that tower?" Charles said gloomily. "The one I wrecked, that's literally falling down around our ears?"
A closer examination of the shallows near the beach revealed that a number of the large blocks had fallen there,
and lazily spinning in the water were several of the doors.
"Look,"
Charles said, pointing to one of the doors.
"A rising sun is carved into that one. I think it's Hittite."
"That means the tower is still crumbling," said Bert. "The effects of scattered time may be worse here. We must be on our guard."
"You mean on our guard enough so we don't lose any more children?" John asked bitterly. "Quiet, all of you," Avon said, her tone making it clear that she wasn't asking for debate. "Don't you see? You're scaring her to death." Sitting nearby, huddled into a ball on the sand, was Laura Glue. She hadn't said a word, but tears were welling in her eyes, and it was obvious she was very, very frightened. John and Charles felt like idiots. Both men knelt and consoled the small girl. "We're sorry, Laura Glue," said John. "Sometimes adults get scared too, and we say things we don't really mean." Laura Glue looked up and sniffed.
So you're not a scared after all?" "Scared out of our wits," Charles admitted. "But that doesn't mean we can't keep our wits about us. And it doesn't mean we're going to leave Jack to the mercy of those awful machines." "It doesn't," she exclaimed, eyes shining.
She reached up and took each of their hands.
"Are we going to rescue Jack's?" "We are indeed," stated Charles, with a furtive look at Bert and Avon. "How can we fail with our good luck girl, Laura Glue, guiding us?"
John examined the history to discover the next steps they needed to take, while the others scouted the beach. It was decided that building a fire would be too risky, since it might draw attention to them, and at the moment they had no idea where the army of golden giants was. Laura Glue told them that the giants were not the same as the clockworks her grandfather had warned her about, the ones they believed had taken the lost boys. This was both reassuring and troubling at once. It meant that there was an additional mystery to be solved, but also that there might be another adversary to be dealt with. Bert calculated that a stone from the keep was falling about every hour, which meant that every 3 days or so, another intersection crumbled, and another door fell too. So every 3 days, another entry point into the past became unfocused, uncontrolled, and loosed upon the world.
"Stay close," Bert cautioned. "Jules and I have had no small experience with time, and if there are any soft places about, I don't want any of us to step into them by accident."
"Look for a horn," John said suddenly. "Somewhere here on the shore should be a horn to summon a ferryman." In short order, Avon called out to them from an outcropping just to the north. There, on a tripod of ash, bound with a silver cord, was a conch shell.
"I think this is it," said John.
"Do any of you know how to use it?" Without replying, Avon lifted the conch to her lips and sounded a long, clear note that echoed across the water. In moments, as if from nowhere, a long, flat boat appeared, propelled by a ferryman using a tall, black pole. He was dressed in a black leather coat and wore his hair cropped short. His skin was pale, and his hair so white it was devoid of colour. But he seemed no older than John, and his face was expressionless. He wore round black glasses that hid his eyes, but as the boat approached, he raised a hand in greeting. Charles gulped.
"Ah, are you Charon?" he said hesitantly.
The man nodded once.
"I was called as such long ago. Charon, Methos, Morpheus, these were all my names once upon a time, but now I am simply called Kilroy. Have you a coin for the passage?"
John looked at Avon in alarm. Talos had taken the bundles, and with them anything else Daedalus had included to aid in their passage between the islands.
"What kind of coin?" Charles asked suddenly.
"A silver talent is traditional," replied Kilroy. "But any silver coin will do."
Charles fumbled around in his pockets for a moment, pulling them all inside out, until finally he found what he was looking for.
"Aha!"
he said triumphantly.
Will this do the trick?
An Irish punt? John said in surprise.
It's my lucky coin, said Charles.
I'm not so sure it works, John said wryly.
That's why I hadn't mentioned it before,
Charles admitted.
But on the other hand, I've got it now, and that's lucky enough, isn't it?
He handed the coin to the ferryman, who didn't so much as glance at it before putting it inside the black coat. Kilroy moved back and motioned for them to step onto the boat. The companions took their seats, and with no apparent effort, the ferryman pushed off with the pole, and the boat slid smoothly into open water. Jack woke in darkness. Feeling his way around, he discovered he was in a small stone room, approximately 10 feet wide and 12 feet long. The ceiling was high, and the walls had brackets for candles, but there was no other decoration in the room, which was obviously a cell of some sort. The door was stout, and near the top, higher than Jack could jump, was a small window inset with iron bars. There was just enough ambient light out in the corridor for him to see once his eyes had adjusted, but only just, and it was far too little to tell if he still retained his second shadow. "Hello," Jack called, hesitant. "Is anyone there?" An unexpected answer came drifting through the small window. It was a song, a child's rhyme, sung by a child's voice. "Ring-a-ring-a roses, a pocket full of posies, a tissue, we all fall down." Jack shuddered. It was the song made up by children during the time of the plague in London. It was an older version than the one he himself had known as a child, the first time he was a child, but authentic. A tissue told him so. Sneezing was a common symptom of plague victims, before they fell down dead by the thousands. He called out again. "I'm Jack. Who are you? Who's there?" The singing stopped abruptly. Then, hesitantly, a girl's voice answered. "Abby! Abby Tornado! Why be you here, Jack?" "A giant golden clockwork captured me," Jack replied, "and when I woke up, I was in this room." "A golden clockwork," said another voice, a boy this time. "I should have liked to seen that, I should. I were only taken by a common variety clockwork, nay?" "Are you the lost boys?" Jack asked. "Is this where you were taken?" "Some of us are, and some of us aren't," said Abby Tornado. "There be lots and lots of children here. Some of us be from Haven, and some from elsewheres." "I'm from a place called Prydain," said the boy, "and I want to go home." Prydain, in the archipelago of dreams. Jack had found some of the missing children, at least. "Why were you brought here?" said Jack. "What is this place?" "It was supposed to be a great game," the boy explained. "That's all it was, just a game. A boy like us, but who wore a golden coat and the head and horns of a ram, came to us and told us that if we played a game with him, we would be taken to a place called Pleasure Island, where we'd never have to go to bed, and where we could eat cakes and sweets, and no one would tell us what to do, because there are no grown-ups on Pleasure Island, none at all." "What was the game he asked you to play?" "We were to sneak out of our beds after dark," said the boy, "and we were to go to the docks. Then, as the clock struck midnight, we set the ships on fire." "Why would you do that?" Jack exclaimed. The boy hesitated, then answered in a voice that said he was uncertain himself. I don't know. The music told us to, so we did. And after we set the fires, we waited for the King of Crickets to pick us up in his dragon ships, and they were supposed to take us to Pleasure Island, but they brung us here instead." A chill settled over Jack. The King of Crickets. Orpheus. That explained a great deal. "Did the ships bring all the children here?" "No," said the boy. "Some of us he kept on the ships, and some of us he left here." "No one has been back for days," Abby Tornado said. "We're all hungry. You didn't bring any food, did you?" she asked hopefully. I'm sorry, said Jack. I didn't.
Oh, said Abby.
Well, do you want to play a game?
I don't know many games, Jack admitted.
I want to play Olly Olly Oxenfree, said the boy.
Then, in a smaller voice, he added, I want to go home.
Be brave, said Abby Tornado. Olly Olly Oxenfree.
Olly Olly Oxenfree,
the boy replied, as did another and another girl, then another boy and more, until the sound was a quiet hum of children that echoed throughout the corridors of their dark, dank prison.
It began as a game, Jack said to himself, but it's become a means of survival for them, hasn't it? And for me too, it seems. Olly Olly Oxenfree.
Kilroy, the ferryman, took the companions to the next island, called Fallon, which stood in the fourth district. The ferryman was not verbose, but he answered any questions they asked, simply and without hesitation. The children, Kilroy said, were most likely being taken to the seventh island in the underneath. There was a fortress there that had often been used to keep prisoners, sometimes for centuries, and children were not accepted. On the pebbled shore, the boat slid to a halt, and Kilroy bade the companions farewell. Charles thought to ask him something more, but as the ferryman bent to adjust the rudder, Charles got a glimpse behind the dark glasses. Kilroy had no eyes, and where they were supposed to be were rows of sharp ivory teeth. Charles stepped quickly away from the boat and did not look back. Fallon, the sixth island, was nothing more than a great rending in the earth, a huge cleft which glowed with the redness of the mythical pit it inspired.
"Dante following Beatrice?" said John.
"Just so," agreed Bert, indicating a series of steps that had been hewn into the walls. "Lead on, Caveo Principia."
"Thanks a lot," said John.
As with the crossing from Haven to Centrum Terre, the opening at the bottom of the rift was connected to the next island by a bridge, although this one was not nearly as trustworthy as the first. It was made of thick, ropey strands of what could have been a spider web, and their feet stuck wherever they stepped. As they crossed, it became more and more of an effort to move easily, and they were all relieved when they finally set foot on solid earth once more.
"Remember," Bert cautioned, "this is also Circe's island. It could be more dangerous than all the rest combined."
The island, which the history said was called Aea, looked like any island in the Mediterranean. There were olive trees and short, scrubby bushes, and here and there they could see scorpions lying in the warm sand. And ahead was a great, foreboding building. It was a fortress in every sense of the word. The structure was not ostentatious by any means, but the various battlements and towers gave testament to what lay underneath. The towers were capped with steeply pitched roofs, and the outer wall was ringed with archways of sculpted stone. At the wall nearest the companions were three great metal-reinforced oaken doors, each with a small window inset about 10 feet off the ground.
"Do we knock?" Charles asked. "What does it say in the history, John?"
"It doesn't," John replied. "So I suppose knocking is as good an idea as any other."
"Then again," said Charles, "what if it brings out more hostiles? I'd rather avoid a battle if we can help it."
Avon rolled her eyes and rapped her knuckles firmly on the door.
"That settles that," said Charles.
There was no response, so Avon knocked again. Finally, a panel in the window slid back and a meek voice spoke.
"What do you want?"
The companions looked at one another, and Avon gave John a nudge.
"Ah," John began, "we're looking for a friend of ours, a small fellow called Jack."
"Hmm," the doorman said. "No Jack here, I'm afraid. No, all we've got here is children. Sorry I couldn't help you."
And with that, the panel slid shut.
"Hey!" Avon yelled, pounding on the door. "Jack is a child! Let us in!"
The panel slid back again.
Well, why didn't you say so? I can't be expected to know a Jack is also a child. I've got responsibilities, you know. Can't keep track of everything.
There was a clumping noise, followed by the sound of several bolts being thrown back. The door creaked open, and instead of the near giant they expected, they saw that the doorman was only 4 feet tall. The curious creature had a hunchback, a carapace like a beetle's, and 6 arms. There were 2 discs on his head, which looked as if they'd been horny growths that had been filed down. One eye was rheumy, the other an empty socket, and his face was sullen. "Where's Jack?" said John. "Can you take us to him?"
"I'm sorry," the 6-armed creature said plaintively. "There have to be forms. I can't release anyone until you've filled out the proper forms."
Charles stepped forward and raised a finger.
"I can handle that," he declared. "I'm an editor. I know how to deal with paperwork."
The odd little creature led them down a series of corridors, talking all the way. Apparently he didn't get many visitors, and so was taking full advantage of the opportunity to get acquainted.
"I'm called Asterius," he said without looking back, "and I assure you, anything you've heard about me certainly isn't true."
"What would we have heard of you?" Bert asked.
"I can leave whenever I want,"
Asterius replied.
"I just choose not to. I'm also of noble blood, did you know? Could you tell?" "Yes," he continued, answering himself. "Noble blood. It's obvious."
Charles looked at John and twirled a finger at his temple. John grinned and nodded.
"I don't usually mix with commoners. Not that I have any time to," Asterius said. "There's always so much to do here."
"Where is here, exactly?" asked John.
"My house," Asterius said, surprised. "Didn't you know? You came to see me after all."
"Actually, we came for Jack,"
Charles said mildly. Asterius deflated slightly.
"Oh, yes, that's right. Well, paperwork," he said.
"You have a very large house," Bert observed.
"As well I should," the creature replied. "It is as big as creation, after all."
"That big?"
said Charles.
"Oh, yes," said Asterius. "Maybe bigger."
"Do you have many visitors?"
asked Bert.
"No," Asterius answered. "Not many. Oh, every 9 years or so, someone comes along who wants to fight. But that's about it."
The corridor opened into a broad room filled with shelves, old bones, and papyrus rolls. The little creature positioned himself on a high stool and began to shuffle through a sheaf of documents.
"Yes," he continued somewhat mournfully. "Ever since that brat Theseus put my eye out, I've been stuck here at a desk job. I should be out wandering the countryside, spreading fear and terror wherever I roam."
Asterius sighed. He looked at Charles with a one eye.
"You don't believe me. You don't think I'm capable of spreading fear, do you? I never get any respect."
"Oh, I assure you, you're considerably fearsome,"
Charles said, elbowing John.
"Oh, yes," agreed John. "Fearful. Terrifying. I wouldn't sleep for nights if I even got a glimpse of you on the horizon."
"Really?"
the little creature said, eyes brightening. He sat slightly taller, as much taller as the carapace would allow, and seemed to puff out his chest.
"Well, then, now that's been established, what can I do for you?"
"Jack," Avon said, exasperated. "We're here for Jack."
Said Asterius. "All I have here is unsuitables. Is Jack unsuitable?"
"Unsuitable for what?" said John.
"To fight,"
said Asterius.
"To fight in the Great Crusade. Those who were suitable went with the king, and those who were unsuitable came here. You really are rather unlearned, aren't you?
Having found whatever documentation it was he needed, Asterius led the companions back into the great labyrinth of halls and corridors, still talking all the way.
"Here we are,"
he announced, hefting the lamp to a short pedestal to better light the spacious room they had entered.
"The Edificium."
It was a great octagon, but, their strange guide explained, it appeared from a distance as a tetragon. "Why is that significant?" asked John.
"It's a Christian conceit," said Charles. "The tetragon is supposed to be the perfect physical expression of the permanence and solidity of the kingdom of God."
"The Abbey of the Rose,"
Bert exclaimed, snapping his fingers.
"Stellan knew of it. He once said that the design of this place was based on the original plans for the Library of Babel, although whether he meant before or after the Great Confusion, I'm not sure."
All the shelves in the Edificium, or Sacred Library, were heavily laden with Bibles. There were incunabula from centuries past, leather-bound Bibles from recent decades, and hand-bound, illuminated manuscripts that had been lovingly, carefully illustrated by the monks who had once resided in the abbey. In his conservative estimate, John calculated that the room contained 12,000 Bibles.
"The other papers are in order, so if you'll just choose the Bible that opens the gate,"
said Asterius, pointing to an impossibly solid wrought-iron door,
"then we can go retrieve Lord Jack."
"Which one do we choose?" asked John.
"I'm not doing this for my health, you know," Asterius complained. "There are covenants, and there are bindings, and I've already extended courtesies to you regarding the discrepancies in the paperwork. But if you don't even know how to get in..."
The little creature let the words trail off into silence, as the companions looked around in despair at all the books.
"Here," said Bert, pointing to letters engraved above the gate. "Perhaps this will give us a clue."
"Could it be a riddle, like the one outside Samarant's lair?" asked Avon. "Or a magic word?" Bert shook his head.
"The monks of the abbey would have eschewed any use of magic words. A riddle is possible, though. Can you read what it says?"
"I can,"
said Charles, taking the lamp from Asterius and holding it high to illuminate the lettering.
"It's Hebrew."
He looked over the letters for a moment, lips moving silently, then turned to the others.
"I think it is a riddle," he told them, "but I don't know what it means, because the phrase itself is no mystery at all."
He turned back to the riddle and began to recite.
"The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them."
John looked startled.
"You know it?"
Bert asked him.
"Yes," John said. "It's from the Old Testament. Isaiah, unless I miss my guess."
"You didn't," said Charles. "But what does it mean?"
"All along," mused John, "we've made mistakes and missteps because we were thinking like adults instead of like children. We haven't even paid enough attention when we knew it would be important to do so. I think this means exactly what it says. We must be led by a little child." They all turned to Laura Glue, and Charles knelt in front of her.
"Laura Glue," he said gently, "our good luck charm. Can you help us?"
"I'll try," she replied cautiously.
She looked at the books, then slowly began to circle the room. She passed the illuminated Bibles John would have chosen, and the incunabula that would have been Charles's preference. Finally, she stopped and withdrew a small, battered Bible from the shelf. It was an old German Bible, and it was small enough to easily fit in her hands. A child's Bible. Inside was an aged slip of paper with the outline of two tiny hands.
"Albert's hands,"
Asterius said, taking it from her and nodding.
"The ghost tracings of a child long gone are still totemic and still bear power. You have found what you need."
nimbly, Asterius folded the paper into a key and inserted it into the lock on the gate, which instantly